Hello, I'm Dean Andrews, Program Manager of TechNet Webcasts here at Microsoft. You're about to listen to one of our first audio-only webcasts, which was taken from one of our popular video webcasts. We've heard from many of our webcast viewers that having offline, audio-only versions would be valuable, so we're trying it out. We'd love to get your feedback on how valuable and effective this format is for you. After you listen, please take a couple minutes and go to webcastaudio.com to complete a quick survey. That's webcastaudio.com, webcastaudio.com. Thanks for the feedback, and enjoy this audio-only webcast.
And without further delay, I'd like to introduce today's presenter, Harold Wong. Harold Wong is a senior technology specialist with the TechNet presenter team. He spent his first 5 years with Microsoft as a field systems engineer, concentrating on Microsoft Windows, Microsoft Exchange Server, and Microsoft Live Communications Server. Outside of work, Harold enjoys playing golf and eating lots of sushi. Harold, I'll hand it over to you.
Thank you very much, Aurora. I hope everyone can hear me okay. If not, please jump in, put something in the panel so that we know. I've been modifying my Scientronics headset here. Just want to make sure we're okay. But either way, want to welcome you to the last part, part 14 of 14 in this series. For those of you who have been on this entire series, I am very thankful and grateful that you were able to do so. Hopefully you found most of the sessions very useful and educational for your environment. I know I've received a lot of emails, so I count that as a good thing. And today's session is on Service Pack 2. I'm not going to cover every feature of Service Pack 2, but we will get into some of the key pieces that are available with SP2 on Exchange 2003. Once again, if you need my email address, make sure you notate it. It is right here, harold.wong@microsoft.com, and I will start updating my blog here shortly with information on the webcast series. So blogs.technet.com/haroldwong. And I also want to thank John Baker, who is online on the back end taking your questions. I will ask that you please be patient with him, as he is the only one. There's over 100, probably close to 200 of you online, so it makes it very difficult for him to answer every question in a second or less. So please be patient. And generally speaking, as someone that does a lot of Q&A myself for my teammates, John's probably not listening very well to what I'm saying. He's not following along with the demos since he's busy fielding the questions, doing research, and making sure that he answers the questions appropriately. So it's kind of hard for him to answer questions that are related to, Harold just said this, can you please clarify? And I'll say that because I know it's difficult for him to follow along. If you do miss anything, please feel free to send me an email. You have my email address, and I will respond back to you and give you the answer to those types of things that I was covering, since I know John can't listen and answer questions very well. I've been in that same position. So please be patient. But for those of you who know or who have been on the webcast series before, you, I'm sure, remember what the format is. We're going to cover some new things, but before we do that, we always get into a review of the last session, which in our case was from Friday. But here's the three things we're going to cover as it relates to SP2, right? New mobility features, spam protection, and mailbox improvements. And always list the prerequisite knowledge, hoping that you guys all have this good experience, and I'm sure you do. Been working with Microsoft and whatnot for a little while, and with email. So we'll jump into the agenda and get going here. If I can get my screens to move. Okay, so here we go. We're going to start with the review and then we'll jump into the agenda. So on Friday, I covered off on mobility. Right? We looked at things associated with OMA, the Outlook Mobile Access, the Exchange Active Sync, which is the over-the-air sync process, and we looked at how you can secure those two processes. So when you look at OMA and you say, well, what exactly is OMA? Well, OMA is really taking the OWA interface, right, that Outlook Web Access, and exposing it to non-Windows-based type devices. So your mobile devices that are WAP-enabled, this is essentially a text version of OWA. So when you authenticate into your OMA session, you get a text format that shows inbox, calendar, contact, and you click through with your phone. So it's just a textual representation, essentially, of your OWA interface, of your mailbox. And when you look at the WAP devices out there, we prefer WAP 2.0 because that's the more secure interface. And then from the versions of HTML that are supported, I mean, you look at HTML, there's CHTML and XHTML. Those are the browser-type interfaces or languages that are supported via OMA. And when you look at WAP, remember that there's a couple of ways to do this. You can come in via a WAP gateway through your provider. You can come in through a WAP gateway that you set up. But either way, it's best in terms of security that you go with WAP 2.0 on the device as well as WAP 2.0 on the gateway. Because if you have anything that's a WAP 1.0 gateway in the environment, even though you're using a WAP 2.0 device, you're still going to have that security, we'll call it a loophole, right? The possibility of someone sniffing in because things are being translated, SSL is being decrypted, and then it's being re-encrypted on a different layer out to your devices. So it's always best to stick with 2.0 all the way across. And then when you look at ActiveSync as just a product that you install on your desktop, if you want to upgrade to the latest one, that is 4.1, which does support USB, infrared, Bluetooth, serial. Right? So it's got better support for contacts in terms of allowing pictures to be synchronized with your Windows mobile devices so that you can have a picture associated with contacts. And when you look at the Exchange ActiveSync, which is the over-the-air sync, we now support not only calendar, contacts, and inbox, we also support over-the-air sync of tasks, right? And when you look at that Exchange ActiveSync, we recommend that you do take advantage of SSL. And when you use SSL, you can turn that on that Exchange ActiveSync virtual directory, or you can just turn it on for the entire website, right? The entire IIS website piece that the Exchange ActiveSync falls under, right? So two different levels of which you can secure and force SSL encryption. One of the other nice things with Windows Mobile 5 is the better support for the direct push technology, where you can actually push emails out to the user rather than them doing a pull sync. We can do the push sync, kind of competes more with the BlackBerry RIM devices. Also, we can enforce policy. So when you look at the policy enhancements, I showed you that on my demo last Friday, where I forced a password of so many characters. Set the policy that if someone tried to enter in the wrong password so many times that we'll just do a wipe. Or what I also showed was the remote wipe capability. So let's just say that I do lose my device, I call into the help desk, and because I know I've got confidential information, right, emails, confidential contacts, and so forth, I want to make sure that that device, all the data on it is wiped out. So I can call in to the help desk, and then they go ahead and bring up the remote admin or the mobile admin tool, which is released on the website, by the way. You can then go ahead and send a remote wipe command down to that Windows Mobile 5 device. The next time it does a sync, boom, it wipes out that device. And it does set it back to essentially whatever was on the ROM, so it's still a usable device. It just doesn't have any of your data on there. So I love that capability of remote wipe. All right, so when you look at OMA, I'll be honest, very few customers that I know of will actually use OMA. Generally speaking, even with the Trio 650 devices, you can do Exchange ActiveSync, which is not OMA, by the way. You can actually access and turn on ActiveSync or the Exchange ActiveSync without using OMA. So those devices being capable of doing ActiveSync over the air, I would highly encourage you to take advantage of that rather than doing OMA, which is like hitting an OAuth page where you're browsing at that moment in time rather than things being synchronized with your device. All right, and then also, one other thing I wanted to mention, if I can remember what it was. With the Outlook, the Exchange ActiveSync, there's a lot of devices out there now that do support the Exchange ActiveSync. It doesn't have to be the Microsoft Windows mobile devices. It could be a combination of, you know, there's Symbian just announced, Nokia just announced. We've talked about Trio 650s, and then the Trio 700 coming out soon will be a Windows Mobile 5 device. And then when you look at turning on this Outlook Mobile Access and Exchange ActiveSync capability, you have two different places that you can turn it on. One's on the server side, and one is on the actual user side, the individual user. By default, all users are enabled for OWA and OMA. So it's already turned on a user-by-user basis. But when you go turn it on, when you look at the settings on the server, the default setting on the server side is that Exchange Active Sync is on the server. However, OMA is disabled on the server. So you do need to go in and turn on the OMA capability on the server side if you wish to expose that. Right? So with Windows Mobile 5, you've got a whole lot of applications like MSN Messenger, you've got Pocket Outlook, you've got your Pocket Word and Pocket Excel, you know, a whole lot of good tools that allow you to do a lot of different things. And one of the ones that's also coming out, not out there yet, is a Pocket Communicator. Right, so the version of Communicator that interacts with Live Communication Server will also be available here in the next, I want to say, 6 months for the Windows Mobile 5 platform, which is something I'm really looking forward to and can't wait for. All right, so that is a quick down and dirty review of what we talked about on Friday. So let's just go ahead and take a look at some review questions. I know there's quite a few of them, but let's just make sure that we're all on track and okay with what was discussed. So when you look at the new version of ActiveSync, which sync methods or link methods are supported? And it looks like most of you are getting it correct of the ones that are voting. So let's go ahead and show the results. And you can see it is all of the above. USB, Bluetooth, infrared, serial, right? So let's go on to the actual slide that shows you the answer, and then we'll take a look at the next question. So when you're looking at OMA, in terms of the version or the language, which one of these is not supported? So in my review, I did mention three of them, right? One of them I did not mention, and it looks like the majority of you are getting it correct. I'll give it another second while I take a sip of my coffee. And let's go ahead and show the results. It looks like 59% of you got it right. It is indeed DHTML that is not supported on the WAP devices via OMA. All right, so let's go take a look at the next question. And this is one where it says, okay, the user is enabled for Exchange Active Sync and OMA, but what is the setting on the server by default? And I mentioned this. What is on or what's enabled versus disabled by default? Now, I'll help you out. There's one item that's disabled by default and one that's enabled by default. So that kind of knocks out two of the questions or two of the answers. Give you a second here. And it looks like most of you are getting it correct. Let me show you the results. Most of you voted for the first option, which is indeed the correct answer. Right? So OMA is disabled by default on the server side, while ActiveSync or Exchange ActiveSync is enabled by default on the server side. All right, now let's take a look at a trick question. I talked about security as it relates to OMA. So this one's asking, which environment should I be concerned with from a security issue when utilizing WAP, Wireless Application Protocol? And it looks like most of you are actually getting it correct, which is good, because like I said, this is somewhat of a trick question. So let me, it dropped down, but let's show the results. And most of you were voting for option one or two, right? One or two. And let me show you the answer. It is two. Now, one is correct, right? You do have to be aware of devices that are using WAP 1.x. But because of the gateway that comes into play, it's not just the devices. That's why this is somewhat of a trick question. So whether you're using WAP 1X or 2.0 devices, it's still a concern because you have to worry about the gateway as well. So if the gateway is a 1.X gateway, you still have an issue versus using WAP 2.0 gateways. All right, so that was the trick piece. Let's go on to the next question. How do you protect your Exchange ActiveSync virtual directories in terms of applying and enforcing SSL? All right, is it one spot you can set it at? Is it 2, 3, or 4? And it looks like most of you are getting it correct. Let's go ahead and show the results. And most of you selected 2, which is indeed the correct answer. You can set it at the virtual directory location, or you can set it at the upper directory, right, the main website location. So you have a couple of choices there. All right, let's go ahead and look at the next question then as it relates to Windows Mobile 5 features. Hopefully you guys can get this one correct as well. And it looks like most of you that are voting are indeed getting it correct. Let's go ahead and show you the results. It is all of the above, right? You have access to the media player, MSN Instant Messaging, and the different device security features like the policy enforcement things I talked about earlier. Okay, let's go to the next question then. If your device is stolen or lost, what is it that allows an administrator to completely wipe out what was on that device? And I talked about this in my review. It looks like, oh, we switched to almost 100%. It is indeed what you guys are all or most of you are selecting. The answer is remote wipe. All right, so I bring up the mobile admin tool and I send a remote wipe command to that device and I remotely wipe it out. Okay, last question and then we'll get into the new content. All right, when we look at direct push technology, what is it that I can synchronize with my device, with my Windows Mobile 5 device? Is it only calendars, only tasks, only inbox, or all of the above? And it looks like most of you are answering it correctly. Let me show you the results of what you guys are doing. And let me click on the correct slide, which is all of the above. Right? And one of the ones that is not listed here is also contacts. So calendar, tasks, inbox, and contacts are all supported in this direct push capability. All right, so enough of the review. Let's go ahead and jump into today's topic and look at Service Pack 2. One of the first things I want to go over is why we even want to upgrade to Service Pack 2, right? What are the top 10 reasons to upgrade, and then we'll get into each one of those or the majority of those individually. All right, so when we look at Exchange SP2, realize that with SP2, you have a lot more security, a lot more email capabilities, a lot more stuff around mobility. Right? So one of the first things is mobility devices. We support that direct push. We support the policy enforcement, which I did show you last week on Friday, right? I kind of showed you how to set that piece up, so that's this first one here. The direct push along with policy enforcement. The second thing has to do with IMF and sender ID. So we've got an enhanced version of the intelligent message filter, and we've got sender ID capabilities. So we do support that sender ID framework, and we support, you know, the reverse lookup to make sure that people who are sending you emails are indeed, you know, sending from the right SMTP server. And then this one here kind of is the icon for the message store. So with standard edition, prior to SP2, the limit was 16 gig. When you go to SP2, you can now increase it to 75 gig. But by default, it is not increased automatically to 75 gig. So you do need to edit a registry key to tell Exchange that we now support, and then you put in the number, 25 gig, 33 gig, or 75 gig, right? But it does require a registry entry, and it is supported on Small Business Server 2003 SP1. So if you already have SP1 on SBS 2003, you can actually apply Exchange 2003 SP2 with no problems. You still need to do the registry entry in order to increase the limit from 16 to 75 or whatever number you wish. Right? Another thing is with public folders. We now have better support for public folder administration in terms of replication, moving replicas, as well as detection of who's deleting public folders, because that was a big request, so we've now added that in as well. Also, along with mobile devices, including Outlook and Cache Mode, is the support for GZIP. So when you're doing this Exchange ActiveSync over the air, we do have the GZIP protocol, so we're sending less over the air. We're doing a lot less around that mobile communication, around that remote communication, so that you have a better experience and a quicker experience. In terms of GAL lookup, we actually have the ability for you to, from your mobile device, that's one thing I forgot to demo last week, was the ability to actually do a remote lookup of the GAL without actually connecting in, per se, with OWA. I mean, you actually just go into your contacts and you do a remote lookup, type in the name, and it connects to the Exchange Active Sync environment on the server side, does a lookup on the GAL, and returns information to you. So you can actually get that detailed view of GAL information from your mobile device. We also support certificate-based authentication, or certificate-based authentication. Rather than using your domain name and password, you can actually use certificates now for that authentication, which for me is a big plus because my password is well over 50 characters. And I'm always concerned about saving my password on the device in case it does get stolen, even though I can do the remote wipe, right? But if you have to type that in all the time, that becomes painful. But you can take advantage of certificates, as well as we now support S/MIME on our mobile devices. Also, around migration tools, we now officially support the GroupWise migration tools for GroupWise 6X mailboxes or post offices. So that's always a plus as well. All right, so, and then the last one right here, cache mode. You can actually now set not only what version of the client you allow to connect, which we've supported since the Exchange 2000 Service Pack 1 or 2, I believe it was, where you can actually go in and say, I'm going to only allow these versions of Outlook to connect. With SP2, we now also included an additional entry that says, I'm only going to allow Outlook 2003 clients with cache mode enabled to connect so that I enforce cache mode in my environment. Now, that's a server-side thing that says if the Outlook client is not set with cache mode, I don't let them connect. It is not actually a setting that then pushes the cache mode setting down to the Outlook client. It's enforcing the clients that are not using cache mode. It doesn't let them connect, but you still have to go out and set the setting on all your Outlook clients at that point. All right, so top 10 reasons for why you should go to SP2. And these are great tools, great enhancements, great capabilities, depending on what you're utilizing. But I do know I've got a lot of feedback around this one piece. For those customers who are on Standard Edition, they love the fact that they can now go to SP or go to 75 gigs on that device, as well as the ability to do these pieces around mobile devices. Those are the biggest ones that I've gotten the most feedback on, just in case you're curious. All right, so let's go ahead and jump forward, and let's look at some of these mobile email improvements in a little bit more detail. All right, so when you look at the direct push technology, what you have here is, let me bring up my little arrow thing here. You have emails being submitted on the Exchange server. It goes into the user mailbox right over here, and at that point, what happens is the email is either sent directly to the device with a direct push, or this other option still does exist. If you want to take advantage of the always up to date, we can still use this new SMS message. All right, so both of those still work. Just wanted to point out that there is still AUTD, right, always up to date. AUTD. It does take advantage of SMS messages. In SP2, we now also support SMTP messages rather than just SMS, right, the short message system. So you can take advantage of that, or if you're using direct push, forget about that SMS message, right? So if I'm using direct push, I don't care about this piece. I am just going to go ahead and take advantage of this piece right here, where my device has a open HTTPS connection to the server that's kind of kept alive. It's not always active, it's just it keeps it alive. And then that way the Exchange server can send the email directly to the device. And I did demo that on Friday. But I sent an email and I had both the Windows Mobile 5 emulator device up and I had my Outlook box or Outlook open with access or open to my inbox. And the email was pushed to my mobile device before my Outlook client even refreshed in cache mode the inbox to see the email flow in there, right? It was quicker by about 15 seconds to my mobile device, right? And so that's a great capability, and it does not need SMS, although if you want to take advantage of AUTD, you can still do it with SMS or with SMTP. Right? To turn this capability on, you do not need to set up anything associated with OMA. Right? This is the Exchange Active Sync. It is not OMA. We don't care about defining a mobile carrier and the email domain name for that. We don't care about any of that because this is coming in through a different window, which is the Exchange Active Sync. It is not OMA, so please don't get those two confused. As it relates to security, I've already talked about the remote wipe last week, and I talked about policy settings last week, but you can, with the appropriate version of Windows Mobile 5 and the little add-on tool there, you can actually set up these pieces so that I can go in and do a remote wipe. I can force policy. One of the policies I talked about was the fact that, hey, you know, if it's secured, it's locked, and someone enters the wrong passcode in, after X amount of bad attempts, I can wipe that device. So let's say I set it to 3, and then I go ahead and I put in 3 bad commands or 3 bad passwords, then it will perform a wipe. But at that point, it's not considered a remote wipe. That is considered a local wipe. All right. So we do have remote wipe and local wipe capabilities. The remote wipe is where the admin goes into the mobile admin tool and sends the remote wipe command over the air to the device. The local wipe is where, based on policy, whatever I've set up, such as after 3 bad password entries, go ahead and wipe the device. It's a local wipe that takes place at that point. All right. Excuse me while I cough. And then I talked about this as well, where we do support additional data compression, and that is gzip support. All right, so we do support that gzip capability. It ensures that we have less data being transferred across the air to the devices. And then we actually have access to our global address list. So the nice thing about this lookup is, let's say I couldn't remember the name of the person I was looking for, but if I just typed in like H-A-R-O, and left it at that and hit OK, it would send and look for anything with H-A-R-O in the name. And that might return Harold Wong, it might return Harold Smith or whatever it is, right? So this is a great GAL lookup capability, is built into the Windows Mobile 5 devices now. And I love that capability. I really, really do. All right. Let's see. What else did I want to say? I think that was about it. So remember, most of these things in terms of enhanced support is around Outlook, around mobile devices. So if you can't wait for those Windows Mobile 5 devices to come out like me, just be a little bit more patient. Most of them are due out in the January to February timeframe in this upcoming calendar year. But SP2 is out, so at least you can get your Exchange systems prepped and ready to go. All right, let's go ahead and take a look at the review questions and see how we did in terms of remembering what we just covered. So if I set a policy that says, you know, the device needs to be wiped out after so many incorrect entries of the password, what piece is actually or what feature is actually performing that? And it looks like most of you are getting it correct. Let me show you what you guys are voting on. Click on the slide with the correct answer. It is a local wipe. Right? The remote wipe is where the administrator sends it remotely. Otherwise, it's a local wipe that is performed. All right, let's take a look at the next question. So let's see how we are doing with Alt-D. How often will your mobile device synchronize with the server? I know I didn't cover this in great detail, but I did go over this. Right? So remember, Alt-D is where you're always up to date. So just think about what that means if you're always up to date. And it looks like most of you are getting this correct. Let me show you the results. 82% guessed the correct answer or selected the correct answer. It is the third option, which is when it receives a new email notification. Remember, though, with Alt-D, that is where a message, a special SMS message or SMTP message is sent to the device to tell it to sync. Right, that is not the direct push technology. So we still support Alt-D, but if you really want the direct push, that's slightly different. So just keep that in mind. All right, which of the following is not new feature in SP2? All right, so I talked about some capabilities in SP2, and this has to do with remote devices, right, or mobile devices. We added support for what? I just covered off on two of them on the last slide just before, at least one of them on the last slide just before we went to the review questions. And this is the last review question, by the way, before we get going back into content. And it looks like 50-ish percent of you are getting it correct. It is indeed the second option. Right, so I showed you, and I talked about looking up the global address list, which is a new feature. I talked about data compression, right, which is gzip compression. And I also spoke about the S/MIME support for your mobile devices, as well as certificate-based authentication. Right, but there's nothing about accessing stored contacts list. All right, so you do have the ability to sync your contacts, but you don't access a stored contact list on the server per se. Okay, so let's move and change gears a little bit and talk more about better fighting or protection against spam stuff. All right, so when you look at the intelligent message filter, we have updated it, and it is now integrated into the product rather than a separate add-on. So with version 1, you downloaded it, you installed it, and then you got an extra tab in the global settings properties sending or something. I'll have to go look. But it's one of those properties in the global settings. You would see an IMF tab, and then you would go to your protocols, and you would see an IMF component over there. Well, now it's just all integrated in, and it's just part of it. Whether you want to use it or not, it's just there. If you don't want to use it, don't turn it on, right? But the caveat here is before you install SP2, you need to go and uninstall IMF version 1, or you'll have some issues, all right? So you do need to uninstall the first version of the IMF and then do the SP2 update, right? And then you'll be good to go. And what we've done with the new version of IMF is we now also support not only the anti-spam stuff, the spam confidence level, which is the SCL over here. We also now support what's called the PCL, the phishing confidence level. So now we're looking for not only the spam attacks, but we're looking for the phishing attacks, the phishing attempts, right, where people are trying to say they are from eBay and they send you the email saying, hey, eBay customer or PayPal customer or Chase customer or Capital One customer, Wells Fargo, whatever your financial institution is, they're sending you this email that says, hey, due to high internet fraudulent activity, we need you to connect to our site and update your personal information. So please click the link below and log in. Right, those are those phishing attempts, P-H-I-S-H-I-N-G, where they're trying to fish around and get you to go to their website, enter in your information thinking you're on your financial institution's website, and now all of a sudden they've captured it. And now they're going to go around and try to get access to your actual data. Right, so the new IMF does support looking at those phishing attempts as well as just the spam stuff. In addition also to the new IMF is something called custom waitlist. Right? You can actually create your own custom waitlist that says, hey, based on the body of the email having this type of text or the subject containing the following text or both the body and subject containing this type of text, let's go ahead and add to the overall SCL rating or reduce from the overall SCL rating. All right. But this is not the way to say, hey, all emails coming from, you know, harold.haroldwong.com automatically has a SCL of 1. That's not what this is for. This is not looking at the from and to field. The custom wait list is allowing you to analyze the subject and the body to modify the SCL. So it's not setting an absolute number. It's saying, hey, let's subtract 5 from whatever the IMF comes up with. Let's add 3 to whatever the IMF is coming up with. All right, so that's what this custom waitlist is. By default, there is no custom waitlist that comes with SP2. All right, it doesn't exist. Instead, what you need to do is you need to create your own custom wait list. And when you create that custom wait list, the custom wait list is essentially an XML file. And this XML file is got a certain format. So if you want to go ahead and do a lookup on the internet, look for SP2 README, or after you install the SP2 files, look at the README. There's information in there that talks about how to create this and where to put it. Right? But ultimately, you want to find your binary files, and that's the bin directory inside the Exchange server directory. And then there's another directory called MSCF version 2, or V2. You're going to create this custom wait list with a specific name to the file, and you're going to store it in that directory. And if you didn't have it already, when the Exchange service is started up, you'll just have to restart the SA, and it'll look at that, and it'll start utilizing it. And whenever you update the list, after it's already seen the list once in there, it'll go ahead and refresh its understanding based on your updates to the list. All right, but by default, remember, the custom waits list is not there. It is not created by default. One does not exist. You have to create your own. All right, the next thing is around sender ID. Sender ID is the process in which when a sender is sending an email to you guys, your inbound mail server says, okay, not only am I going to make sure that we meet all the anti-spam stuff, but before we even receive that, I want to look up the IP address of the SMTP server that is sending to me. And when I look that up, I'm essentially checking to make sure that that IP address is on the list of servers that are allowed to send from your domain name. So let's take a look at my example here. Let's say I'm sending from haroldwong.net. And in haroldwong.net, I've got, my mail server is set up for mail1.haroldwong.net, which is fine, right? So now that's my server coming in. It gets checked. This server says, okay, let me do a lookup because it's inbound. Let me look up, and I do a lookup against the DNS server looking for an SPF record. The SPF record then points and says, yes, there is a entry for mail1.haroldwong.net in that list. Therefore, the sending SMTP server is valid for haroldwong.net, and I'll receive the email inbound. Let's say, on the other hand, this is someone trying to spoof haroldwong.net, and so they send an email inbound. When the lookup occurs against the DNS server, so second lookup, it looks for the SPF record, and it sees mail1.haroldwong.net, which resolves to some specific IP address. Maybe that IP address is 10.0.0.1. Well, the sending IP address was 63.65.300.20. Well, that's invalid. Therefore, it will be denied. Or, based on how I set it up, it's going to either delete it, reject it, or send it on in, but put in the information that the SPF lookup, essentially failed. So it's going to put an additional rating on that email, right? And that's essentially what SPF does, or the sender ID. Right, and then that way you can control whether the email comes in or doesn't come in. I know it's a little bit convoluted or might be a little confusing, but take time to look at all the information out on the internet, but understand, by default, most environments don't have an SPF record set up in their DNS, right, because that's fairly new. Microsoft actually does, so we are set up with it, but then you have to define in your setup what do you do when the sender doesn't have an SPF record set up. How do you handle those emails? Because essentially that's a failure. So we'll take a look at that in this upcoming demo. All right, I'm going to go ahead and show you how to create or what you need to do with the custom waits list, and then we'll go in and configure the sender ID and how we actually deal with emails that fail sender ID authentication. All right, so let's go ahead and take a look at my demo here. We ought to have a screen up and running. You ought to see a couple of different things, but either way, it's a blue desktop. You can hit F5 or Control H to go more full screen. and then you can see it a little bit better. I've actually cheated. I actually have a sample file on here that talks about what this custom wait list is and kind of has a few entries in there. You can always go and grab it yourself. There's a sample on the website in the README file, I believe, or at least if you go do a search for custom wait list on the Internet, you ought to be able to find a sample because it goes into samples of what you might want to do. So if you look here, there's a custom wait entry. We put the type of body versus type of subject versus both. So this is saying, you know, search the body. If I find this following text, then I'm going to change my rating by subtracting one. On this one, if I have a special offer in the body, I'm going to add 5. Right, so if my SCL rating would have come back as a 4, because that's what the IMF would have put on there, we've now told it to add 5 to that rating. So now the SCL will be 9. I can add 10, but either way, the SCL rating will always be between 0 and 9. So know that. If you get it outside of that range, it'll normalize it back down to 9 if it's above the 9, or if you make it a negative number, it'll bring it up to, zero. All right, so there are ranges that are valid. If I do both, then the type is saying that I'm checking both the body and the subject for certain things. So if you want to put in, maybe, let's go ahead and add another entry. Maybe you have someone that you communicate with on a regular basis, and you might want to say, hey, for this customer, whenever they send an email in, I'm going to make it look nice, I'm going to say, change this one to be -9, and the text is going to be, you know, whatever that is, you know, Herald's communication. And if they use that in the subject field, I'm always going to make sure that it has the lowest SCL rating possible, because to me, that's valid email. We've agreed that whenever you send me an email, you're going to use this subject, and then I know it's always going to come in. So you could do something like this, right? And then what you need to do is save this file. So let me go ahead and do a save as. I'm going to go to my C drive, go to program files, Exchange server, because that's where I installed Exchange, in the bin directory. And in the bin directory, there is a MSCF version 2 directory. To cheat or make life easier on yourself, I would select all files. And then the name of this file must be msexchange.usecontentfilter.xml. So that, to me, is the easiest way to save that file. And now we've got the file out there. If I restart the Exchange services, then it would process that file and start utilizing it. So let me just show you. Over here on Program Files, Exchange Server bin, MSCF version 2, I now have my XML file. Right. And so if I come in here and open this up, it by default will open in IE, but you actually just want to open it with Notepad and then continue to add in or edit the different entries that you wish to add in. All right, so that's the first piece. Let me go to the next component, which is bringing up Exchange System Manager. As soon as this comes up, let me expand this, go to Global Settings, go to Message Delivery Properties, and you can see there's sender filtering, connection filtering, recipient. The IMF is now integrated, and now we have an additional tab called Sender ID Filtering. And what you need to do here is decide, hey, if sender ID fails, what do I do? Right. So I went to do a sender ID lookup. I couldn't find an SPF record, or something is failing. How do I handle the failure? Do I go ahead and accept the email, and then I put on the sender ID status so that that gets complicated or included in the computation of the SCL? Do I go ahead and delete it or reject it? Deleting means I accept the email, and then I delete it. I just don't NDR it. Rejecting means I kill the connection. I won't even accept the connection. I won't accept the email. So you decide how you want to handle failures. By default, it's going to be set to accept. And then the other place you need to make sure you go turn this on is from the protocol side. So if you go to SMTP, go to your virtual SMTP server, go to Advanced, and then Edit, and then you can choose which of these filters to apply. Because by default, you can see none of the filters are being applied. So if I don't apply the sender ID filter, then it's not, no matter what I do, it's not going to be configured. It's not going to be used by my SMTP virtual server. All right, so those are the two places within Exchange that you need to go modify or edit in order to take advantage of the sender ID framework. The other piece is going in to DNS and adding in an SPF record. Right, and the SPF record is going to be a type of TXT, but do a search on the Internet. I don't have time to actually go in and do all that here because I've got a couple more demos to do as well. But do know that you do also need to put in an SPF record within DNS, and this is your external DNS. All right, the things that are going to be resolved or hit by your clients as you try to send to them. Right, so we just finish that first demo looking at our custom wait list. Remember, nothing is defined by default. You have to define it. You have to create it and then store it in that one directory. And then I showed you where you need to go configure your sender ID and the fact that it does, you know, the new IMF does look at anti-phishing scams as well as the spam scams. So let's go ahead and take a look at our review questions and see what we can get out of this. Or how we did in terms of paying attention, or how well I got the information out to you. So what's one of the improvements in the IMF in terms of how we, or what additional thing we look for in spam emails? And it looks like most of you are getting this right. Let me show you the results here. 81% of you did select the correct answer, which is phishing scams. And I'm sure most of you by now have seen at least one of those phishing scams. And I know I've seen many, many, many of them from institutions that I don't even, you know, have an account at. I've seen those phishing scams targeted at just about every financial institution. All right. Where is the custom waits list located? And this one is somewhat tricky. I'm going to say that there are really two correct answers, right? Depends on how I ask this. Where is the custom wait list by default located? Let's ask it that way. Where is the custom wait list by default located? Or where can it be found by default? All right. So if I ask it that way, most of you are not getting it correct. Let me show you the results, and let's go show you the right answer. So by default, where is the custom wait list located? Well, it isn't located anywhere. Remember, you have to go create your own list. Now, where do you store the file that you create? It is indeed number 2 at that point, right? So it does have to be in the MSCF version 2 folder, which is inside the bin directory. So there's a specific location to put it, as I did in the demo, but by default, there is no such list. So you have to go create it. Kind of a tricky question. All right, last review question, and then we'll jump into the last chunk of information for this content. What kind of email does sender ID email authentication protocol help prevent? So let's take a look. It was a close tie. Let me show you the results. Most of you are guessing between spoofing scams or a combination of spoofing and phishing. And it is actually both phishing and spoofing. Because technically, when you look at phishing scams, those are kind of like spoofing scams as well. But the fact that they're phishing, the emails are coming not really from, you know, PayPal. They're not really coming from Wells Fargo. They're coming from somewhere else. So whoever the initial sender is, it's not, they're not using those institutions' SMTP addresses. All right, so both phishing and spoofing. Because depends on how you look at it. Phishing is kind of like spoofing. All right, let's go ahead and move forward and take a look at a few more items as it relates to mailbox enhancements. The first one being the increased mailbox limits. I don't know why, but my slide is not building, so hopefully yours is. But in standard edition, it used to be 16 gig. With SP2, it's up to 75 gigs now. But remember, by default, it actually only goes to 18 gig. you have to actually edit the registry to tell it to go to 75 or whatever number you wish to set it to. All right. The next thing has to do with the offline address book. Prior to SP2, there were different situations that would require a full offline address book re-download, and the synchronization between differentials was not as clean as it could be or should be. So with SP2, what we've done is implemented a new offline address book folder and a new architecture. So you'll see an OAB version 4 folder now. And with that, you have a data.oab offline address book. The data.oab is essentially your offline address book. It's the full offline address book. But as changes occur to the offline address book, what happens is we put in this binpatch.oab. Right? It's the binary differentials. And that's what gets synchronized to your clients rather than the full data.oab. So we now just update these little differentials, and then the client, when they receive it on the client side over here, the client side will take the binpatch.oab, the differences, and incorporate it into its version that's already downloaded on the client side of the data.oab file. And therefore, we have fewer synchronization or less synchronization occurring, less traffic, and we've also enhanced it so that there are fewer things that would actually require a complete download of the data.oab file again. So in the past, one of the common things was, let's say you went in and you moved or you changed the phone number or you picked up a new area code and your city or where you're located happens to have that new area code configuration. So you go in and you modify every email or every mailbox to have this new phone number, which is changing the area code. Well, that would have forced a complete data OAB to be downloaded again, right, the entire offline address book to be downloaded again in previous versions. Well, now that does not require a complete reload. It still just takes advantage of the binpatch.oab. And one of the other requirements, and I do need to point this out, is the client must be running Outlook 2003 SP2 or higher. Right now we're on SP2, but I will say or higher just in case it releases SP3 later. All right, so you do have to have a specific version of the Outlook client as well to take advantage of this. Otherwise, you'll continue to take advantage of the version 3 mechanism. So let's just go ahead and take a look at how we can actually manage our offline address book settings. All right, so there are different things that you can do, and these are unfortunately registry related. So let's go ahead and take a look at our demo here. I am going to, hopefully, you guys are seeing my desktop on my virtual machine. Remember, F5 or Control H will bring you to full screen. And let me bring up my registry editor. With the registry editor, kind of notate where I'm going, but we do need to go to H key local machine, system, current control set, services, and it's Microsoft MS Exchange SA. All right, so over here, go into parameters, and you'll see some default parameters that are in here. We actually have to go in and add some additional ones, depending on what you want to take advantage of with this OAB4 component. So there are certain things that you can do in terms of setting the limit size for the different string. And let me just go ahead and create a new D word value. So if you want to write this down, the D word or the actual name is OAL space V4 space string limit. Right, and this is where you set the string limit for this is the limit in terms of how much data you can put in or how much data is changed before that full rebuild occurs. Right, so let me go ahead and change this by default. If you don't set this key, the actual default value is 3,400 bytes. All right, so if you put in 3,400 bytes, well, that's the default. if you change it from the default, if you put this value in, then it will use it. Otherwise, it does default to 3400. So maybe I want to change it to 3600. I can go ahead and add that particular value in. All right. The lower limit is 32 bytes, so you can actually go as low as 32, but you can set the upper limit. So, but remember, the default was 3400. So if you don't put anything in, it defaults to 3400. And then you can also put a limit in terms of your binary limit. So versus, there's the string versus binary. Binary is things such as like a certificate, things that are stored in binary values. So this is going to be called OALV4 binary limit. Right? And the binary limit by default is 32,768. Right, the lower limit is 1,024 bytes. Okay, but remember, if you don't set this value, it does default to 32,768. So, if you're going to set this value, it doesn't make sense to set it to default, which is what I'm doing, just so that I can show you what the default value is. But just know, by default, if it doesn't find anything in here or any settings in here, it just goes to the default value. All right. So those are two key things that you might want to go in and modify, and this is what's going to define whether, you know, what dictates a rebuild or a full download of the offline address book. Right? These two settings are the key things you want to look at. All right, and that was a very quick demo. I know it's a registry entry fiasco, if you want to call it that, or most people don't like going into the registry. And I don't blame you. Most of the times, we don't recommend that you go into the registry and modify things. But this is a case where in order to control these OAB settings, you do have to go into the registry, and it is the registry of the Exchange server. All right. So remember, there's the OALV4 binary limit versus OALV4 string limit. Those are the two things you want to take a look at. And let's go ahead and move on to one more slide, and then we'll jump into one more demo. And this has to do with public folders. All right, I talked about better public folder administration, and this one built all out, but that's okay. One of the things about the public folders that we've made an enhancement on is, let's say you started a replication process by adding a replica of this 14-gig public folder instance, and you've decided to replicate it to another server. So you went ahead and added that replica to server 2. Upon doing that, well, public folders immediately start to replicate. And that's a 14-gig public folder instance that you did not realize until you started it going, and then you're like, oh my gosh, that's not what I meant to do, because it's now 9 o'clock in the morning, and I am just killing my servers with that replication. Well, prior to SP2, there's nothing you could do. You'd have to just let it finish replicating. With SP2, you can actually now say, hey, stop all public folders from replicating. And then you can, you know, so you're pausing the replication process, and then at 4 o'clock, you can restart or unpause the replication process. Or let's say you had 14 replicas on this particular server. You want to decommission the server. There's actually now a option in the menu to say, hey, let's just move all the replicas from this server to another server. So it makes it easier to do that mass moving of replicas. I love that capability, especially for those of you who are trying to decommission a particular public folder or server. You can actually just easily do that now, right, by forcing all the replicas to be moved to a different server. You also have within the menu option to force a public folder hierarchy synchronization. So if you've noticed that, hey, on this server I see a list of public folders that don't exist on the other one, maybe replication hasn't completed, or there's a little out of sync thing with the hierarchy synchronization, so you can force that to sync. You can use the public folders wizard to go in and manage your public folders in terms of client permissions, setting up client permissions to a given public folder, which means like this set of users can, you know, have authoring editor rights, this one has author rights, this has publishing author, this has none, right, client permissions. You can also use this to add or remove specific replicas from your public folder subtrees. And you can also force, using this wizard, all the settings to be pushed down the folder hierarchy. So at this particular folder level, I set these permissions. I now want that to be pushed down, right, all the way down that entire subtree. And the last thing, big thing that customers have been asking for was, you know, people are going in and deleting our public folders, and we would like to know who's doing what. Can you please start tracking that? So now we do allow you to track who's deleting the public folder, so the mailbox and the AD user object associated with the deletion attempt and the name of the folder that was deleted. All right, so I will show you how to turn these on and, you know, where in the interface to take advantage of that, and that's what this upcoming demo is. So let's go ahead and jump back to my machine here, if I can get it to come up. Where's my Exchange? There we go. Here's my Exchange server. So we have Exchange here. Let me bring up my system manager. One thing you do need to do before you can track deletions is you actually have to turn it on. So if I go to the properties of my server, and this is on a server basis, we go to Diagnostics Logging. And then we bring up the MS Exchange IS, Public Folder, and General. All right, so let me just show you. I'm going to cancel out of this real quick. I'm going to go to my folders, public folders. Notice there's no public folders here. I'm going to go ahead and create a couple. So test one and create a new one. Test two. Let's bring up my event viewer. Go to my application log. Right now I don't have anything in there. Let's go ahead and delete test one. So I'm going to go ahead and delete this. And let's refresh my application log. And you can see there's nothing added in. All right, so I'm not tracking anything yet because by default we don't turn that capability on. So let me go back to Diagnostics Logging, Exchange IS, Public Folder, General, and set it to medium and click OK. And now, as soon as this accepts the change, it turns on the logging to medium, and it can't be minimum. It has to be at least medium or that particular piece is not tracked. So it has to be at least at the medium level. And now let's go to test two, hit delete, say yes, go back to event viewer, and refresh my application log. And you see another entry now in there, right, event ID 9682. And if I open this up, it tells me that folder test two was deleted by boom, 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 administrator, user account is Fabricram administrator. So the first one was the mailbox. The second one was the AD user object, just in case the two don't match up in terms of the name of the mailbox and the name of the user. So we do now track it, but it is storing it in the application log of Event Viewer. Right? And then some of the other things that I talked to you about or I talked about in the previous slide, if I right-click on the entire organization, I can actually stop public folder content replication. Right? So if I stop it, later on I can choose to resume it. Right? So I'm stopping for the entire organization. It's not on a server-by-server basis, but it's stopping the entire organization replication hierarchy from taking place until I resume it. Right? So I'll go ahead and resume it, and boom. Now, you know, at 4 o'clock I can resume that replication, and that 14 gig replica will replicate over and not eat up all the the utilization and the bandwidth. If I go to the server storage group public folder store, if I right click, I can choose to resend changes. I can choose to move all replicas. Right, so if I want to move all the replicas that are stored on this server to another server, it brings up and I need to select another server. In my case, I don't have one. That's why this list is coming up blank. All right. I also have, if I right-click on the public folders, I can choose to synchronize hierarchy. All right, so I can force that synchronization of the hierarchy, and life is good there as well. So those are the key pieces. Right, so we've made some enhancements, some changes to the public folders and or how we deal with public folders here. So hopefully that gives you some better control and meets the needs that you are looking for. But I know that we were asked by customers to please have a way to stop public folder replication in case it gets started inadvertently, right? And that was one of the big pieces there. All right, so let's take a look at the review questions, and then we'll bring this to a close. I only have three review questions, starting with the first one. If we're using Offline Address Book version 4, which file actually contains the changes? All right, so it's the changes only, the deltas. And it looks like most of you are getting this correct, are the ones participating. Let me show you the results and click on the answer. It is bin patch. All right, so remember that data OAB is the actual compilation, the actual offline address book, the entire one. It's the bin patch that then gets downloaded and then incorporated into data.oab. Okay, second question. When does a replication storm occur? Now, I didn't cover this, but I want to see how you guys do. It's hopefully straightforward. You know, what happens or what is a replication storm or what's a traffic storm? And it looks like most of you are getting this correct, so let me show the results. It is that first one, right, when there's lots of data being replicated over the network. Don't you just like this one, though? It rains during replication. Whew. I thought that was kind of funny. All right, last review question. Which of the following can you not use the Managed Public Folder Wizard for? All right, so I talked about it in the, and I didn't actually demo this. I just realized I forgot to demo this one setting. But in that, the deck, it was talking about what I can do with this wizard, like modifying client permissions and so on. One of them is not listed. And it looks like an even split between all of them. It's actually the fourth one, right? To synchronize the public folder hierarchy, it's not part of that particular wizard. I just right-click, and it just shows up on the list of things. So that was synchronized public folder hierarchy or synchronized hierarchy. It was not part of the wizard. All right, and that brings us then to the end of this particular part, 14, where we talked about some SP2 enhancements around mobility, around security, around the anti-spam, right, the new IMF capability that includes anti-phishing stuff, as well as the sender ID framework. And then we looked at some enhancements to the mailbox management, right, around size limit increase. Also took a look at public folder enhancements around management of public folders. One of the things I didn't demo but I talked about briefly was forcing on the Exchange side to only allow Outlook 2003 clients that have cache mode turned on. Right, that doesn't turn it on the client. It's just saying on the server side, if you don't have it turned on, I'm not going to allow you to connect. So that brings us then to the end of this particular part as well as to the entire series. So I hope you did enjoy the entire series. I hope you did have some good learnings out of it. And just out of curiosity, let me just throw up one more poll slide, if you'll just bear with me. How many of you attended all 14 parts? Yes? No? Hey, what happened to my poll? Oh, there it is. Okay, so I guess I asked the wrong question, but did you attend all 14 parts? Is it a yes or a no? Yes or a no? So it looks like 23% of you that are voting, or 25% now, have attended all 14 parts. And as I look through the list of names that people signed in, I do recognize quite a few of you. I recognize some that have been emailing me with questions and have been participating. So I thank all of you. Those 25% of you that have attended all 14 parts, your chances of winning the little giveaway, I believe, is probably a little higher than those that have only attended, you know, one or two. But either way, let's go ahead and turn it back over to Aurora, and that way you can go fill out the survey. And thank you, John, for taking all the questions. I see there are quite a few in the queue still. I will answer them in the Q&A panel so that you can see the answers come across. Aurora, back to you.
All right. Thanks so much, Harold. So here we just have some next steps for everybody. You can download the Microsoft Exchange Server 2003 Evaluation Edition, download the Exchange Server 2003 Service Pack 2, and then also visit Exchange Server 2003 Virtual Lab. And then here we just have the link for you. If you did miss some of the parts in this 14-part series, you can go back to that link and watch any of the ones that you missed, the on-demand. So that is a good resource for you there. And again, to access all these links, you can use your print to PDF option under your file menu. You'll also be receiving that email tomorrow with a link to the PowerPoint. So attend any live webcast in the Exchange Server 2003 in-depth webcast series, and you could win an IMA SP3 smartphone. One smartphone will be awarded per webcast from November 2nd through December 14th today. And survey completion is required for entry. I'll be putting that survey up in just one moment. And here you do have all the URLs where you can connect with TechNet. You can get free technical briefings, the TechNet / newsletter, TechNet Online, more TechNet webcasts, TechNet subscription. So just go ahead and start up Microsoft.com/TechNet. And if you do also fill out the survey that I will be providing in just one moment, you will also have a chance to win a 40-gigabyte MP3 WMA player. So attend any live Microsoft webcast through June 2006, and you will have a chance to win this MP3 player. Survey completion is required for entry into that giveaway as well. So now I'm going to go ahead and put that survey up. The comments and feedback that you give us do allow us to create better webcasts for you, so your feedback is always very valuable to us. If you have any problems seeing that survey, just turn your seat to red or let me know in the Q&A panel there today. And with that, we'll go ahead and close out the webcast. I'd like to extend a special thank you to Harold for presenting today and to John for answering questions there on the back end. And thanks, everyone, for attending today's webcast. Ladies and gentlemen, that concludes today's TechNet webcast. Thanks for joining us. You may now disconnect from the audio portion of this conference.
Hello, it's Dean Andrews again. Thanks for listening to the webcast. We value your feedback, so please take a couple minutes and go to webcastaudio.com to complete that quick survey. That website again is webcastaudio.com, webcastaudio.com. Thanks, and have a great day.